From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and we want to start this hour in California, where a restful holiday weekend turned into an emergency helicopter evacuation for more than 200 campers trapped by that raging wildfire in the Sierra National Forest.
This past weekend was one of the hottest in the state's history. Temperatures soared above 120 degrees in parts of Southern California, fueling fires that are still burning. California Governor Gavin Newsom has now declared a state of emergency. And for the latest, we're joined by Jacob Margolis, reporter with KPCC in Southern California. And Jacob, the state's fire chief says more than 2 million acres have burned across the state so far this year, record-breaking numbers. Give us a sense of how big these current fires are.
Yeah, I mean, it's been a rough year. These fires that we're seeing now aren't as large or as numerous as the fires in August. You know, those were record-setting. They're still going technically. They were absolutely insane. They were driven by just thousands of lightning strikes across the state. But the fires that are burning right now are still, I mean, supremely destructive and scary and life-altering for many. So since Friday, we've seen three major ones that at least I'm focused on. The Creek Fire is up in Sierra National Forest. Those were the rescues that you mentioned. It's at about 73,000 acres, and it's fast-moving. It's dangerous. We've seen some pretty extreme fire weather up there as well. And down here in Southern California, we're dealing with the Valley Fire. And most notably for me is the El Dorado Fire, which is at 7,400 acres in the San Bernardino Mountains. The kicker for that one is it was started not by lightning, but by a gender reveal party gone wrong, which is devastating and frustrating for all of us that are looking at sepia skies right now.
Absolutely. It was set off by fireworks at that gender reveal party. You mentioned the heat. I mean, San Francisco hit 100 degrees, downtown Los Angeles, 112, San Luis Obispo, 120, breaking all of the records. How unprecedented are temperatures like this, and how is it contributing to the spread of these fires?
Yeah, so it was actually near where I am, it was 121 degrees, which set the record for Los Angeles. And heat impacts a lot of things. It's in and of itself is not going to cause the fire, but the heat does dry things out. It raises the ambient air temperature so that the matter that catches on fire is technically closer to its combustion point. You know, we're already at critical dryness across Southern California, so stuff is going to burn. But on top of all that, the heat really impacts not only just vegetation, but the firefighters who are out in it. Heat stroke is very real. They've been on fires for weeks now. Exhaustion is very real. They need a break. 121 degrees, I can tell you, is very hot.
Absolutely. I mean, I woke up to ash all over my car and my neighbor's cars here in the Los Angeles area. The Bay Area is entering its third week of poor air quality. Air quality is a significant issue right now. Is there any relief ahead?
Yeah, it looks like, it depends on how much of a handle they get on these fires, but it looks like temperatures are going to start to drop, which is good, which might improve air quality a little bit, at least in Southern California. The problem is we're looking at Santa Ana winds possibly rolling through, or I think they are going to roll through on Tuesday and Wednesday. Santa Ana winds bring wind gusts up to 50 miles per hour this time around. And so those are really the fires that, like in past years, we've seen burn all the way to the ocean. Those are driven by Santa Ana winds, just really strong winds that firefighters can't always get ahead of those kinds of fires because they're just moving so fast. So we have to see how the next day goes.
Jacob, I want to ask you about the winds as well as the lightning strikes that you mentioned earlier. These fires have generated their own thunderstorms with lightning as well as massive winds. This is a phenomenon that may be surprising to some. How is that happening?
Yeah, so when big vegetation like trees or just vegetation burns, moisture flies up into the air, basically condenses along with the ash, creating these gigantic, huge pyrocumulus clouds. They can turn into pyrocumulonimbus clouds, which create lightning. But pyrocumulus on their own are also very dangerous because they create very erratic weather. The fires, which means that like the fire gets, it ends up spotting, so it gets pushed all around. It can be hard to fly aircraft through there. Yesterday we saw one of those collapse, and that was really concerning because it created just wild weather. So impacts a lot.
Absolutely. That's Jacob Margolis, reporter with KPCC. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, we're keeping a close eye on colleges as they reopen for the fall. A New York Times review of 203 counties with lots of students found those areas saw spikes of COVID-19 cases in recent weeks, and returning students are thought to be a cause. Some schools are asking students to sign waivers, absolving the school from any responsibility if they catch COVID-19. This past weekend, Northeastern University dismissed 11 students who broke the rules and were found partying without social distancing or any masks. And the school is keeping their tuition. But some schools have less leverage. At Indiana University, over half the fraternity and sorority houses are under quarantine. One house has a positive test rate of over 87%. Now, the school is recommending that all 40 Greek houses shut down. But that's all they can do is recommend, because the fraternal organizations own the houses, not the school. Michael Reschke is a reporter for the Herald Times in Bloomington. And Michael, there are more than 2,500 students in frats and sorority houses at IU. Cases are surging in those houses, but not in the dorms. Remind us why.
It's a communal living situation with shared bathrooms and sometimes 60, 70, 80 people living in one house at one time, although the county asked them to put in some guidelines to help them limit the spread. And one of those was limiting occupancy to 75, ideally 50%. And the fraternity and sorority houses were, at least to my knowledge, willing to do that. But they are living close together in one large building.
Well, the university says it expects the national organizations for every house to help students fulfill the school's recommendation that they, you know, shut down the house and live somewhere else. And so they expect the national organizations to help them with those alternate living arrangements, although IU said it would support the students to ensure they can continue on their academic journey. What are the national organizations saying?
The North American Intra-Fraternity Conference put out a statement saying they didn't think it was a good idea for them to move out of their houses. IU has its own interfraternity council, which is a group of leaders from its fraternity houses. Both of them cited Anthony Fauci's recent recommendation that sending people home now after they've kind of already been together back to potentially vulnerable family members just wouldn't be a good idea.
Because they would infect people all along the way as they travel back home and then infect people back home. But right now, they're in danger of infecting people right in the community. You know, people who might work at the local stores. What are people in the community saying?
The community has been really worried about this. That's why there's been a lot of collaboration between the university and the county health department and city and county governments. And there has to be for stuff like this, because the quarantine is actually coming from the Monroe County Health Department as opposed to the university, because, again, the university doesn't own the houses. They can't tell them what to do, so it has to come from the county. And it's actually a request that members quarantine, and there's 33 out of 40 sorority and fraternity houses at IU Bloomington currently under quarantine.
And that's extraordinary. And I'm wondering what other students are saying, because in the Boston area, when Northeastern dismissed out of hand 11 students holding on to thousands of dollars in their tuition money, say they're not giving it back, a lot of students were quoted as saying they were glad because they were seeing some of these were incoming freshmen. They were seeing them not wearing masks, not social distancing. They were feeling threatened by them. What about students there? Yes, you might have, you know, some of the houses under quarantine. They're not leaving. But how do students on the campus feel about the notion that there are that many sick students in those houses?
I think it depends on the person. I talked to some people that are in sorority and fraternities, a few of them that are living out because they're seniors. A lot of seniors do that. And one sorority member that I talked to said she could see it from both sides. It's a really tough situation. What are you supposed to do? I mean, do you keep them there or just kind of all together? And especially at this point, where would they go? Would they find another house in Bloomington? The university has said they don't have quarantine housing. So finding an apartment at this point in a college town is difficult. Mm. Some might have to go home. And that's kind of the worry.
Who's taking care of them if some of them are very sick? Are some of them very sick?
As far as I can tell, there haven't been any hospital admissions from the Greek community at IU because of COVID-19. That's coming from somebody on IU's medical team. There was a lot of partying the week before school started. IU administration sent out some really strongly worded letters, and we had some IU students that are doing freelance reporting for us. They went out that weekend before classes started, after those statements went out, and they couldn't really find large parties anymore. So it seemed like students were, at least for the time being, kind of taking heed to this. But I mean, these are really big buildings that people could go in, and, you know, walking outside, you wouldn't necessarily know what's going on inside.
Michael Reschke, a reporter at the Herald Times in Bloomington, Indiana, about the COVID-19 outbreak in the Greek system at Indiana University. Michael, thank you.
Thank you.
Marion Nestle, spelled like Nestle as in chocolate, has been thinking about the intersection of food, science, politics, and public health for the last 20 years. She's written some of the country's most authoritative books on how food ends up on the grocery shelf, books that are weighty, maybe too weighty for some. So her new book, Let's Ask Marion, takes care of that. It can fit in your pocket. It's divided into short sections, each answering a specific question like, why does nutrition advice seem to change? Should we take supplements? Marion Nestle is a professor of nutrition, food studies, and public health at New York University. She also has a PhD in molecular biology, so she's got this covered, literally, from farm to table. Professor Nestle, welcome back.
Glad to be here.
You know, one of the points you make is that food is political. Give us that big overarching thought first.
Well, all you have to do is look at what's happening with the coronavirus and the people in the meatpacking plants who were forced to work even though they were getting sick because the meat industry got the president to invoke the Defense Production Act to force them to go to work. That's food politics.
Yeah, you point out that people who are some of the most underappreciated workers in the country are suddenly necessary.
Essential.
Yeah.
These are people who don't get paid well, who often don't have sick leave or healthcare benefits. The average wage of people in meatpacking plants is under $30,000 a year, and they are working under really dangerous, crowded conditions. No wonder they get sick. Nearly 60,000 meatpacking and farm workers have gotten sick so far. It's a lot.
I was thinking, too, about the pandemic in general, the fact that it's thought to have started in a wet market in China, which is where live animals are sold and slaughtered for food. PETA's been trying to shut them down for years. And it's thought an animal from China was sick and it might have been a bat bite. And we had a scientist on who explained that the bats are being driven from their natural habitats by climate change. So they're closer to these places that they wouldn't ordinarily have been. There's just a lot involved in food.
Well, it's one of the things I love about it is it connects to absolutely everything. The most important issues in the world all connect to food in one way or another. And I think the coronavirus pandemic is a perfect example of that.
Well, let's get to some of the questions that you are asked in your book by your friend and colleague, Carrie Truman. She asks, first of all, what exactly is a healthy diet?
Well, I think it's so simple that Michael Pollan can say it in 7 words. Eat food, not too much, mostly plants. Really, that's all there is to it. And then these days, the concept of ultra-processed is a relatively new concept, and it means foods that are industrially produced with ingredients that you can't pronounce and that you don't have in your home kitchen. They have a lot of additives. So it's a polite word for junk foods. If you avoid those, you will probably be eating fewer calories and eating much more healthfully. Eat your vegetables. Try not to eat too much. It's really good advice.
Well, but what if you, and here's where you talk about food and inequity. You might live in an area where there aren't vegetables available, or, you know, vegetables have somehow become far more expensive than junk.
Yeah, isn't that one of the absolute ironies of the food system is that over the last 30 years, the price of fruits and vegetables has increased much, much more than the price of sodas or fast food or junk foods in general. Well, that gets us right into the whole question of food policy and politics again. There are reasons why vegetables are more expensive. And when people say they can't afford them, I have a lot of sympathy for that. I think we need a food policy that makes healthy food affordable and available and accessible to everybody.
We know that the government subsidizes things like sugars from corn, and that helps make sodas cheaper. How can you make vegetables less expensive through policy?
Well, first of all, you decide that you want a agricultural system that's going to promote health and I hope sustainability. And you develop a whole series of policies in order to make it easy for farmers to grow vegetables. You subsidize land for them so that they can actually grow these things. You take the subsidies away from corn and soybeans and you put it into foods that are going to make people healthier. My favorite example of the way government policies don't work has to do with marketing to children, which is something that particularly bothers me. Food companies spend billions of dollars marketing to children, and every penny of that is deductible as a business expense. That's one of the first things I'd change.
Let's get back to what we should eat. You point out that sometimes when it comes to whether or not something is good for us, we have to sort of tease back who's deciding. So if an industry funds the research, you might smell a rat.
Well, I certainly do, and wrote a book about it. What a coincidence. Its results almost always favor the sponsor's interest. And that's something that troubles me a lot. I wish we had more public money for nutrition research. But as long as we don't, people are going to take money from food companies. And it's pretty hard not to be influenced, particularly because the influence of gifts occurs at an almost unconscious level. People just aren't aware of it.
Where are you on fake meat?
I have a really complicated position about it because I don't know yet what the answers are to my questions about health and sustainability. I think everybody would be better off eating less meat because of the connection between high meat diets and various kinds of diseases, and also the effects of meat production on the environment, because that's the biggest food source of greenhouse gases. But fake meats, which are ultra-processed foods, they have multiple ingredients that you can't find in home kitchens. And it's not clear yet what their effect is on the environment or on health. They're trying to make their product appear to be meat. And they do a pretty good job of that. I've eaten those products and they look like meat. They taste like meat. One big review just came out and it kind of says more research needed. I'm always for more research.
I love that you close that answer by saying you're waiting to see the next iteration of these fake meat products. Laboratory-based meats created from cultured muscle cells.
Oh, yum. Right.
Supplements. You talk about this being self-medicating. Your stand on supplements.
Well, more than half of Americans take supplements of one kind or another, despite the fact that there's almost no evidence that they make healthy people healthier. They're probably not harmful. And if they're just expensive placebos and people feel better, these days, I'm for anything that makes people feel better.
As long as it doesn't, you know, do harm on the other side of the equation. And talk about, you know, when food does harm. We waste so much food, or how agriculture contributes to global warming.
Yeah, I mean, those are huge problems. The agricultural contribution worldwide to global warming is probably about a quarter of greenhouse gases. Climate change is making it really hard to grow crops the way we're used to. They're moving north. But the main harm from food in the United States is people eating too much of it. The too much is built into the system. We have about 4,000 calories available in the American food supply. That's less exports plus imports. We only need about half of that. And so waste is built into the system. And the estimate that I've seen is that about 70% of food waste comes at the production level, 10% comes at the retail level, much less than I would have expected, and then 20% what we do in our homes. But the real problem is at the production level, and it's really hard to deal with.
Yeah, because it's industry, it's jobs, it goes back to those government subsidies, it's all of that.
And the example that I like to give is I visited a farm in upstate New York and was told by the farmer, just go take anything you want out of the fields because we can't use it. It was the wrong size. We tried every food bank in upstate New York and nobody could come here. They don't have the trucks. They don't have the people to come and pick it up. I mean, that's the kind of thing that breaks your heart, but it's very, very difficult to deal with.
Yeah, creating systems. Marion Nestle, what do you think happens to our relationship with food because of this pandemic. I mean, you know, people have been cooking more. People have also been lining up for free food at pantries because they don't have enough, not going to restaurants as much. What's your sense of what this pandemic does to food?
Well, it's done just absolutely shocking things. And the most shocking was the discovery that there are two completely different food supply chains in the United States, one for restaurants and other institutions like schools, and one for retail. They don't interact at all. So that when restaurants and schools closed, all this food piled up and was being destroyed at the same time that people who were out of work were lining up at food banks to get handouts of food. We haven't seen anything like this since the Great Depression of the 1930s. But what's happening on an individual basis is also quite mixed. Sales of processed foods are going up, ultra-processed foods, because they have a long shelf life and they're cheap. But at the same time, people bought more seeds. They were growing more of their own foods. You cannot buy a canning jar in upstate New York because everybody is dealing with the produce from all those seeds they planted. So that's a good sign. People are cooking more. That, it seems to me, is a real step forward and something that I hope will last beyond this.
Marion Nestle, professor of nutrition, food studies, and public health at New York University, talking about her new handy pocketbook. It's called Let's Ask Marion. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Massive protests against President Alexander Lukashenko continue in Belarus. The BBC's Jonah Fisher joins us from Kiev. And Jonah, these protests have been out in the streets for 4 weeks now since the disputed presidential election. Is either side showing any signs of backing down?
Not really. It's fairly clear that President Alexander Lukashenko, the man who's run Belarus for the last 26 years, still has a pretty firm grip on the security apparatus, so the police and the military. And at the same time, it's pretty clear from the size of the demonstrations that he has lost any public popular support that he might have had previously. I mean, yesterday I was in Minsk, absolutely huge crowds, well in excess of 100,000 people walking through the very center of town and right up to barricades which were manned by these riot police. And what has changed in the last few weeks, and this is a real big change for Belarus, which previously was effectively a very tightly controlled police state, is that people no longer fear the riot police in the same way. So throughout yesterday, there were expressions of defiance from these demonstrators towards the riot police because they knew that they had around them tens of thousands of other people who felt the same way. And that has been a really sort of empowering moment for the demonstrators.
Jonah, what role is the opposition leader playing in all of this right now?
Well, Svetlana Tikhanovskaya is the woman who most people think probably won that election 4 weeks ago. She left to Lithuania almost immediately after the result came through, in which President Lukashenko rather improbably claimed to have won 80% of the vote. Since then, there's actually not a great deal of leadership of these demonstrations. People have come together, united by a couple of things: the wish to have President Lukashenko go, the wish for there to be new elections, and in the last few weeks, increasingly, people saying that they're very unhappy with the violent way in which some of these demonstrations have been targeted by President Lukashenko's riot police.
Belarus is a former Soviet republic. Does President Lukashenko have the support of Russian President Vladimir Putin?
He appears to have it for now. And it's not an overly cordial relationship between President Lukashenko and President Putin. And the speculation is that Moscow is effectively saying to President Lukashenko, you are in a weak position. We will continue to try and support you and to allow you to stay in power. But in return for that, we want a much tighter relationship between Belarus and Russia. That has been resisted by President Lukashenko up to now. But the speculation is that now in his weakened position, President Lukashenko really doesn't have much choice other than to really consider very seriously the possibility of giving up some of Belarus's independence, some of its sovereignty, in return for Russia's help staying in power.
Jonah, what do you think the end game is here? I mean, these protests are moving into their fifth week now.
That's a very good question. And looking forward, I think one scenario is that Russia keeps President Lukashenko going for a little while longer in the hope that the demonstrations peter out a bit. And then at some later point, they say, OK, now it's time to put someone else in place, someone who we can really trust and work with, and not you anymore.
That's the BBC's Jonah Fisher. Jonah, thank you so much.
Thank you.
On the evening of January 17th, 2015, a young woman was sexually assaulted on her way home from a party on the Stanford University campus in Palo Alto, California. The young woman, who retained her anonymity as Emily Doe for the duration of the case, penned a viral impact statement that hit a nerve and captured the disassociation many survivors of sexual assault and rape feel. In it, she wrote, "I stood there examining my body beneath the stream of water and decided I don't want my body anymore." That woman's name is Chanel Miller, and after years of remaining anonymous, Chanel wrote a memoir in 2019 aptly called Know My Name. And she's now a speaker and artist, her latest work on display at the Asian Art Museum in San Francisco. Chanel joins us now. Welcome.
Hello, Tanya. Thank you for having me today.
Yes, so your letter and then memoir resonated with so many people. And now you have a 70-foot mural that's visible from the street in San Francisco's Asian Art Museum that you've said is for survivors. The piece is called I Was, I Am, I Will Be. Can you describe this piece and its inspiration?
Yeah, so the piece has three large panels with different characters indicating the I was, I am, I will be. And I think of them as interchangeable panels. They're not meant to be seen in a linear fashion because I believe healing is about circling between these states of being. I know that for me, no matter how successful I become or how much therapy I go to or how much I write through my experiences, there are still days where I'm completely thrown off track, where I have difficulty getting out of bed, where old feelings resurface and dominate the day. And I'm okay with that. I just understand that now I have the tools to address them when they overtake me. I also always know that these phases of relapse into depression, it's not even relapse, it's just like continual life. It's just another phase of sadness that I won't be stuck in it forever. And I think the scariest thing about going through that type of pain before was the aloneness and the worry that it would always be that way. And now I may experience a very similar pain, but I know that it is passing and that I am no longer isolated, and that makes anything bearable.
It really brings up for me, I was thinking as I was reading about your work, that concept of I was, which entails looking back, and you've laid this out for us so well, about how you can excavate the past, what happened to you, and make sense of it without re-traumatizing yourself or accepting that moment that you're in where you're having all of those feelings is a natural part of the process.
Yeah. And, you know, I think a lot about how the stories of the assault themselves are not too much. What survivors fear most is not the telling, but how the telling will be received and the negative backlash that might happen. And so I think that if society can create a context where when we speak, we actually trust that we'll be listened to, then we won't feel so terrified of sharing these stories. Because I think sharing is a possibility and should happen. It's just that the reception needs to change.
You've said that the character depicted in the mural has perfectly circular nostrils to reflect your Asian heritage. You've also said the pressure of the model minority trope was a major reason that you battled whether to come out publicly. How much of the healing has been dismantling this trope and stereotypes associated with Asian American women?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was a huge element of why I felt it was important to become physically visible, to not only have my voice heard, but to assign a face. You know, the features I have, the roundness of my face, like a moon, and my circular nostrils, they might seem like little trivial things, but when you don't see a nose like mine reflected in advertisements and movies, then you think there's no place for it, when that is simply not true. And I also thought a lot about how, you know, someone I had spoken to throughout the court process on the phone, one of the probation officers, had filled out paperwork and checked off the box that said white under my ethnicity. And the fact that she had never even bothered to ask me and made that assumption. And I think it's an assumption a lot of people made, and they didn't do it in a hostile manner, but almost subconsciously, white was the default. And I wanted to confront that and have all of us sit back for a second and question why that was. And then again, just being perceived as submissive or quiet always bothered me, because in the book I write about how, you know, you mistake my quietness for weakness. Someone can be soft-spoken and still possess nuance and complexity and strength. It's just displayed differently. And so I was tired of being undervalued, underestimated, and I wanted to, for people to be able to assign this bold, courageous voice with a young Asian American woman and say, yes, that was me, and it is also you.
You've always been a doodler, and I read that even during the case you were drawing monkeys because it was the year of the monkey, according to the Chinese zodiac, which is your lucky year. When did you start to realize that art was an important part of who you are and who you want to be?
So I always use drawing to process and heal. And also, you know, I drew a lot right before I did the statement, I think as a reminder that I possess so much that I can't always see. But the internal life of me is so vibrant and so everywhere and imaginative. And if I can just get out of my own way and also, you know, ignore the voices that are trying to tell me I'm one small, you know, useless thing, then I can make way for these drawings that want to come out and be seen and take up space. And that's what's happening now.
Healing, as we know, isn't linear. The idea of I was, I am, I will be is kind of a cycle. Now with COVID-19 upending so many people's lives, what do you hope people take away when they see this mural in San Francisco or your other artwork?
I think a lot about how, because there was so much, there was an abrupt stop of gears moving, and all of a sudden you had all this room from old things from the past that you may not have wanted to confront previously, slip their way in now to the present. And so people might be dealing with things that happened a long time ago. And I think allowing the patience to do that is really important. I also think that no matter how much the world reopens or whatever phase of reopening we're in, we haven't even begun to process the loss and trauma of these past months. I know for me, I spent a year and a half in the court proceedings, and I thought, when I secured the verdict, I was done. Like, oh, I did it. When really, that was the first time I could actually exhale and begin doing the work of healing from what just happened. So I think we're still holding our breath in some way. We're still trying to keep afloat. So even if things look a little bit more normal, deeply they are not. And I think we need to protect space and time to continue to figure out how we're psychologically and emotionally affected, and also not delude ourselves with trying to return to a normal, because that normal is gone, and there are many things about it that we don't even want back, right? So we need to continue to pay attention, stay present, and be patient with how long it's going to take to heal from this.
That's Chanel Miller, author of Know My Name, an artist whose mural is on display in San Francisco's Asian Art Museum. Chanel, thank you so much for this conversation.
Tanya, I really enjoyed chatting with you, so thank you.
The U.S. now has 6.2 million confirmed cases of coronavirus, the highest number of any country, and nearly 189,000 deaths. It's a pandemic that's devastating families, communities, changing our lives, our work, our cities. And our next guest is watching what may change with an eye to history and the fact that though it's hard to realize now, great innovations have come from past disasters. Derek Thompson is staff writer at The Atlantic. He joins us from Washington, as he does every Monday. And Derek, your article is titled, Get Ready for the Great Urban Comeback. Hard to imagine now, but after the Great Chicago Fire, for instance, the paper had the headline, Cheer Up. So remind us what you found.
Yes. So I was doing some research a few months ago on the way that cities have responded to calamities. And I read about an earthquake in Lisbon in 1755. And it was such a destructive earthquake that it caused Enlightenment thinkers to totally change the way they thought about civilization. I mean, truly just this absolute urban catastrophe. But it had this interesting side effect. It caused some of the engineers of the late 18th century to begin to rebuild by understanding how earthquakes worked. And really, the first earthquake-resistant buildings ever were built after the Lisbon earthquake of 1755.
Okay, let's talk about some other examples. You write about the cholera epidemic in 1832 in Great Britain. Just horrendous. It just cut a swath through the population there. But what changes were made?
So this cholera epidemic got so bad that the government asked this public health official named Edwin Chadwick to write a report about what was going on throughout England in these industrial cities. And the report was so damning that it caused the English government to essentially pass the first public health laws in the history of Western government. Many public health historians now think that the birth of modern progressive governance, everything that's given us Social Security and Medicare and in other countries universal health care, came from the seed of this ethnography that was written in the 1830s about the cholera epidemic.
Yeah, well, and it was the Great Chicago Fire of 1871 that killed hundreds, 300, I think, burned 20,000 buildings. The whole city was pretty much built out of wood. It was a tinderbox. It was devastating. And it was right after that that the Chicago Tribune had that huge editorial headline, Cheer Up, because the paper said, we will rise again. Rise, they invented the skyscraper.
It's just unbelievable what happened in Chicago. They rebuilt the city in a few years, and they didn't just rebuild. The fact that you had burning embers on the ground in an otherwise rich city attracted a lot of engineers and architects to Chicago who said, how can we fit more building on the same plot of land? And they used new steel skeleton construction technology to build the largest buildings in the world, buildings so tall that by the 1880s, they had to coin a new term to describe how tall these buildings were. That term was skyscraper.
Well, then there's the blizzard in New York City of 1888. 50 inches of snow shut down the entire city. There was a thinking that, you know, how could a city survive this? Because all the technology was above ground. Talk about the changes after that.
Right. So New York in the 1880s had a train system, but it was an elevated train system like Chicago's today. And they just suffered this horrendous blizzard that entirely shut down the city in 1888, destroyed New York, destroyed Boston. And the city leaders at the time said, we are building too many of our electrical wires and our infrastructure above ground. And so the 1888 blizzard gave rise directly to the creation of the New York City subway and the Boston subway, the first subway in U.S. history, and also caused these cities to bury their electrical wires, which ended up improving the ability to electrify the city.
Look, you're quick to point out that there are a lot of disasters that don't make change. Hurricane Katrina comes to mind, some incremental changes there, but not huge ones. And you quote someone who says, if some of these catastrophes had happened only in poor parts of a city, as opposed to shutting down a whole city in most cases, there might not have been a reaction. But bringing us forward to COVID-19, you also remind us that what spurs this change a lot of the time is a realization that we all are interdependent. What do you think might come out of COVID-19?
I think that one thing that this disease has done is demonstrate how inextricably bound up we are. If one person gets sick, they can spread that disease to strangers. So what does that mean for public policy? Well, I think, you know, initially when people were talking about things like universal health care, you know, paid parental leave, those were thought of as giveaways. But maybe seen through the lens of COVID-19, you see that these are actually measures of public health and national security. Because the parents that we're allowing to stay home with the kids, the sick people that we're allowing to stay home from work, the lower income people that we're giving universal health care to, they're a part of the network that includes us. And their health is our health. I think that is a lesson of COVID-19. And I hope it's a lesson that American leaders remember, just as civic city leaders have remembered lessons in the history of urban catastrophe in America.
It'll be interesting to see what happens post-COVID-19. Derek Thompson, staff writer at The Atlantic, thanks as always.
Thank you.
Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.